So this weekend, we hosted our board, FCM, Father Community Mindfulness. We, you know, we're a legal entity. We're a legal entity, and so we have a board of directors, and every year we bring on new board members, and every 3 years we gather to do strategic planning for the whole community for the coming year and 3 years. And let me just quickly introduce them, so if not everybody knows them, just could stand up. The chairperson is John McCarris. John lives in Naples, and John is a longtime practitioner and the father of Max. Marcy Meckling, who is online, is from North Carolina. Ned Bellamy from Clearwater, Ned. Maria Teresa from Tampa. Maria Teresa, Bill Lee from St. Pete. Bill is not here. Chris Lee Nguyen, who's up in the balcony from Fort Myers. Scott Nissen here in Tampa. Jun Fung from Tampa. Misty Oxford Pickerel from Gainesville. And Chris Wittick, who's from Tampa, but he seems to hang out a lot in New Jersey for some strange reason. Why anybody would hang out in New Jersey in December is beyond me. So this is so this is our board. And I won't go into all the things that we that the board discussed at some point that'll be shared with the community. But one of the things that we always begin with is going over kind of what's called our mission statement. Everybody know what a mission statement is, you know, and our value statement. And I wanted to share that with you because I, again, every year I read it like for the first time and I go, wow, this is pretty good. This is really wonderful. And I want to share it to you and talk to you about it a little bit. But before I go there, it was very interesting that a member who's a physician sent me and Angie printed it out, but I think it was like from the AMA Journal of Psychology or Psychology. It's a branch of the American Medical Association. And the article, I won't read the whole thing, was called Mindfulness Reminds Us What Healthcare Is For. And again, this is a journal of the American Medical Association. That's right. Mindfulness reminds us what healthcare is for. And in the abstract, you know, before they have the journal article, they have a little summary abstract. The abstract says, could clinicians help people more if they were Buddhas? I mean, America has come a long way where something like that's appearing in a medical journal. I was like, wow. And then in the abstract, it says, this article considers what the late Thich Nhat Hanh meant by his call to become Buddhas, and applies Nhat Hanh's mindfulness practices to managing crises and anxiety in healthcare settings, et cetera, et cetera. And just in the beginning, it says, the Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh called for us all to become Buddhas at this moment of planetary crisis. The question we wish to address, this is in their article, is why during times of crisis is it useful for individuals to become Buddhas? A short answer is that because crises provoke anxiety, right, which in turn impedes individual and collective decision making, mindfulness is needed to help us improve our thinking. I mean, this is sort of a collective kind of statement, but I think it applies to us all as individuals, right? Because we all face lots of challenges and difficulties in life societally. And if we're in a state of anxiety, if we're in a state of emotional reactivity, it is very hard for us to deal clearly, intelligently, wisely with the problems and issues we face. Both as individuals in our life, but even more so collectively. And you see, and they talk about you know, that what's going on in our society, there is so much anxiety and fear in all sectors of society, right? There is so much anger, right? You know, that you can see, rather than kind of the people of our society coming together to deal with, you know, these incredibly significant issues that we face as a people, as a planet, instead, what do? We seem to become more divisive, more separated, more and more unable to think in any clear, rational way, or to see the commonality of what we share. So anyhow, the object of this article was to promote that medical institutions should become repositories of teaching mindfulness and mindful awareness. I thought there was one interesting thing. They said, pulled in many directions by the rapidly changing demands of the moment, people can become ambulance chasers rather than strategic actors, and they quickly become worn out and discouraged. You know, I think that, I mean, I've never, you know, we all know ambulance chasers, but I realize, you know, that's sort of what we've become, you know, but the information that we're getting us that's promoting the reactivity is what we get from, you know, the news, social media, right? So we're always constantly being bombarded with what? The latest crisis, the latest issue, the latest thing. And so we react to this one, and then we react to that one, and we react to that one, and we get all stirred up about that one. And everybody knows what I'm talking about. And it's interesting to say, you know, we end up like ambulance chasers, right? And never have the wherewithal to stop and say, you know, what's really going on here? You know, and if we don't really know what's going on here, how can we generate, you know, healthy and meaningful? And in their summary, they quote the Swedish environmentalist Greta Thunberg has pointed out that we have to act now by building a new way of life. Even if we don't have a clear blueprint about how to do that, do it. And so they suggest we can begin by pausing, finding stillness, settling the mind and body so that we can see beyond the turbulence and distractions. Within this space, we can become more discerning, being aware of our values, listening and respecting ourselves and one another, thus enabling our co-creation of a platform for truth-telling, recovery, and survival. Quite beautiful. AMA Journal. The other thing I wanted to share before I get into you know, our community values and why we're here, some more bad news. 21 million, or nearly 9% of the population, suffer depression every year. 40 million people. 50% of the American population suffer from drug and alcohol abuse. Almost 40 million people. Right. 20% or 40 million people suffer from anxiety disorders. Basically, between 20 and 26% of the American population, of course, these are mental health people, saying that they have, Americans have diagnosable mental disorders. I mean, quite significant when you see it all like that. Why is that, you see? You know, what is it about our world and our society and the way we live, right, that produces such distress in human beings? You know, I mean, it's, you know, we're sort of aware of these things because what do we hear? We talk to people, we know within ourselves. And people says, yeah, well, you know, suffering from anxiety, or I've been depressed, or people, this one, you know, everybody's in and out of rehab, but we never, you know, step back and go, what, you know, again, what's going on here? Right. So, anyhow. Thich Nhat Hanh, early Thich Nhat Hanh, Right? Everybody, most people know Thich Nhat Hanh? Thich Nhat Hanh is what? Wonderful, right? the father of mindfulness, the father of living in the present moment, the father of making Buddhism very accessible and understandable and very applicable to individual life, family lives, teaching us how to love, all kinds of wonderful things. But this is a very early, one of the first books translated by him back in the late 60s or 70s called Zen Keys. And it's a little, it's interesting, some of the things he said back then. Because in his later writings, you don't hear him talking about things like awakening and enlightenment. And the reason I say that, because you'll see our first value is about awakening. He says, the picture of the enlightened person is that of a free human being who possesses spiritual force and is not the plaything of chance. The practitioner, once enlightened, sees him and herself in their true nature, knows themselves, and possesses a clear view of reality, the reality of one's own being and of the social situation. This vision is the most precious fruit that Zen can offer to human beings. The way of being of the enlightened man or woman is considered to be their most fundamental and most beneficent contribution to all life. Very interesting. Zen is a living tradition which can help to make sober, healthy, well-balanced, and stable people. As I've already said, what we need is not a doctrine, but an awakening that can restore our spiritual force. And then in the end, he says, this is a chapter called the Regeneration of Humanity. The first phase of this civilization must be to establish social conditions in which life can be lived in a human way. Awakened people are certainly, and he put quotes around awakened people. These are not like all fully enlightened Buddhists, but just people who are in the process of wanting to wake up are certainly going to form small communities where life will become simpler and healthy, and time and energy will be devoted to the enrichment of their fundamental humanity and spirituality. So, that is by way of introduction to, something I just wanted to talk with you about, which is, we're here, there are these buildings, everybody here is participating in this activity of meditation, mindfulness, concentration, and now everybody's listening to this talk. Before that, you listened to all the activities that we're doing this week, you know what I'm saying? But what's the context, you see, in which this whole thing is manifesting? Why are we here and why are we doing this? And I guess one of the reasons I was interested in just sharing that earlier article, in terms of healthcare and what they see, and how they want to introduce some kind of capacity for human beings to be somewhat self-aware of their situation so they can make changes. And the reason I quoted those statistics about, and those are just some of the statistics about our world, with all the kind of mental illness and distress that people are going through, how do we respond to that? Three or four weeks ago, I gave a half-day workshop called Responding to the Suffering of the World. And then I think last Sunday, or two Sundays ago, I kind of talked a little more about that and said, you know, we have to kind of reset, and I think this is what we're getting at here, you know, our understanding of the suffering of the world, suffering of people, is really at what is most obvious. I mean, it's sort of like we see the sufferings of people that are most obvious, right? Which is mean we see the symptoms. So we see, you do understand what I'm saying? So we would say, oh yeah, poverty, injustice, war, violence, famine, you know what I mean? Yeah, great human suffering, physical pain, great suffering. So we would all agree, everyone agrees, Buddhas, non-Buddhas, spiritual, non-spiritual, yeah, there's a lot of that kind of suffering. Right? We'd say, oh yeah, you know, addiction is suffering. Right? Anxiety, depression, that's suffering. Anybody who experiences that suffering. But the Buddha taught there are other sufferings, which are actually the ones that are producing those, that are not seen. So the second suffering, and for those who were here last week, I'll just repeat it again, is the suffering of change. You know, that we live in this world where nothing is stable, nothing is permanent, nothing is constant, and everything is constantly changing, right? We don't know what the future is gonna bring, do we? And for a lot of people, that promotes a lot of anxiety and fear, because we live in a world where we gain and we lose, right? We're loved and we love, and then we're not loved and we don't love. We're in, we're out. We're successful, we're unsuccessful. We experience pleasure, but that's only temporary. And then we experience the opposite of pleasure. And I could go on and on, but this impermanent, unstable world, which to us seems like, oh, this is just the way the world is, right? Yeah, things go up, things go down. Sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm sad. Sometimes I gain, sometimes I lose. Sometimes things go my way, things don't go my way. Just being in this world of constant change and instability and unknowing, you know what the Buddha called that? Suffering. Just being caught in that. And then at a deeper level, he said, there's an even deeper level that that human beings experience, all human beings experience. And it's kind of, you know, that kind of deep existential sense of disconnection and separateness, loneliness. It's that, you know, we don't feel connected. Many people don't feel connected to themselves, right? And even though they can love other people, care, we don't have a deep sense of oneness or interconnection or with nature or with life. You see what I'm saying? We're separate. And that kind of separateness that we all feel, the Buddha called that deep suffering. Man, most people aren't even in touch with it. It's always there, but we what? What do we do? What? Yeah, and keep ourselves very busy. Right. So it's to really address the whole area, the whole arena of suffering that the Buddha and Thich Nhat Hanh said, you know, we need to form communities. We need to create places where people can learn another way to live, another way to be, and can learn the technology of how to heal and transform themselves and how to return themselves to wholeness. we might call that awakening. How do I awaken to my essential wholeness, which I've lost? And yet deep down, I know I yearn for. So you can't just get it from a book, you know? Even though there are lots of books. And you can't just get it from a podcast, even though there are lots of podcasts, and there's lots of stuff. But you really only learn it by participating in a process that nurtures and develops that. So the FCM vision, Florida Community Mindfulness vision, is to create a community, eventually a world, where principles of loving kindness, generosity, selflessness result in global peace, environmental sustainability, and cessation of suffering for all beings. Pretty grandiose, eh? And again, we're not the only ones who want a peaceful world, right? I mean, I would hope most sane people would like a peaceful world. People would like, you know, an environment that sustains all human beings and that they're all suffering. So this is very global. This is very general. Lots of people, right, can sign on to this, right? But the mission then gets more particular. It's like, how are we? You see what I'm saying? Like, what's our piece of this? There are 8 billion people out there. There are hundreds of thousands or millions of organizations, agencies, you know, who are all, you know, around this, you know, but what's going to be our piece? You see, like, what's our mission? And so this is what was written. In support of this vision, Florida Community Mindfulness offers Buddhist teachings that are relevant to the realities of day-to-day life and lead to personal transformation. FCM provides a variety of educational and practice opportunities to support those who sincerely aspire to cultivate wisdom, mindfulness, equanimity, compassion, and joyful selfless service to others. It realizes its mission through the creation and nourishment of a healthy and active community where teachings and other practices are shared in an environment of mindfulness and loving kindness under the guidance of their teacher. So that's our mission. There are many, many organizations, religious, non-religious, NGOs, right, nonprofits, that have their mission, right, of how they want to contribute to making this world a more peaceful place, right, to creating, you know, a more sustainable world, saner human beings, to end human suffering, right, which is wonderful. But, you know, the mission of this little tiny universe we're all sitting in today and participate in, you know, this is how we're going about, this is what we're doing with our piece, right? So we sort of become specialists, you know, lots of specialists. So this is kind of our specialty, right? How do we create an environment? How do we share teachings? How do we share the technologies that really facilitate people healing and liberating themselves from their suffering, develop clear thinking, open-heartedness, really pull all the defilements away that prevent them being, you know, a kind and loving and compassionate person in the world? How do they develop, you know, clear discernment so you can really see the wholesome and the unwholesome and really know how to act? So it's a whole process, right, of kind of retraining our minds, retraining our hearts. So that's our mission. So then it gets interesting. So what are our values? And I only say that because, you know, even though I'm talking about vision, mission, core values of an organization, I think it's very important and I think it's very helpful. I mean, the same way that we, with the help of Robbie here, who's a professional in the field, kind of guiding us 10 years ago or something, a long time, you know, when we put this together, in the same way, when we kind of realized we're kind of becoming more of an organization, and we had to kind of get clear, you know, who we are and what we're about and where we're going and what our values are, because we might have kind of had a vague sense of what it is, But, you know, we have people, new members coming in, joining us. You know, how do we let them know who we are? In the same way, how do we make sure that we are always true to our mission and our values? And I say this because I think it's also, you can see how essential it is for an organization that wants to have some integrity about it. But I think it's also important for individuals, for each of us, you know. So just close your eyes a second, then we'll go on. Just close your eyes. I'm going to ask you an interesting question. Do I have clarity in my mind about what my personal mission is in this life? All of us, young or old, we know that we are only here a short time in this body. We all participate in the unfolding of birth, growth, deterioration, and death. So in this time that I have a human life, am I clear about my purpose, my mission? So that's kind of a question to drop down. And it's not like you have to come up with a clear answer, but just asking you, because I think many people don't live with that sense of purpose in their life. Many of us perhaps are more like the ambulance chasers, who just react from situation to situation, crisis to crisis, experience to experience. But is there something underneath that? I'm really aware of sort of like why I'm here and what I want to use this vehicle, this body mind of mine in this lifetime. It's sort of like there's an inner peace. You know, we may have career goals, relationship goals, you know, all those kinds of things. But this is more personal. You know, if the answer is, I never even thought about it, well, you may want to think about it. But if you kind of come up with an answer, then maybe ask yourself, is it really present in me as I go through my day, as I live my life, in my relationships, in my work, how I show up? Do I hold my purpose close to me? Do I forget? Anyhow, to be continued. It's a good question. So the next section, which is, you know, very important for each of us, is, you know, what are our values? Am I clear about the core values that I live my life by? You know, here as a community, we're talking about, you know, the core essential principles, it says, that underline, motivate, and shape and guide our community, right? But as I say, I would say to each of us in the same way, you know, as I'm sharing the communities, you know, think about how that relates to you and your values. So the first one is awakening. Now that's, for Americans, that's kind of strange, isn't it? We don't grow up in a culture where people talk about awakening a lot, enlightenment a lot. Is that true? Is that something you were taught in grade school or high school, or you went to college and they talked about awakening? When you sat around your family at Thanksgiving, were they all talking about awakening? Right. So it's this idea of awakening, of waking up to something, or the somehow that we are asleep to something, is really not part of our conversation, you know. So let me read what it says. The first one: through the practices of mindfulness, deep understanding, wisdom, and compassion, we grow personally, heal psychologically, and transform our suffering into the flowering of an awakened being. We use Buddhist meditative practices to rediscover eternal truths about reality through direct investigation and experience rather than through blind faith and dogma. So that's a very clear definition. You know, there is this process of awakening. There is this process of coming out of our conditioned way of being. There is a way of waking from suffering and delusion and wrong view. There's a way to wake up out of all that, like a bad dream. You ever have a bad dream? Anybody ever have a bad dream? How do you feel when you wake up? What? Relieved, happy. It's like that. How do we wake up out of the bad dream? And how do we flower? And again, what we're saying is, you know, and this goes back to the Buddha, you know, he taught a path of living, right? That was always open to investigation, critical thinking, right? So this is not awakening by taking on, you know, the dogma of awakening, the catechism of awakening, right? The catechism of Buddhism, you know, this is about using the methodology to experiment within our own body mind to decide for ourselves whether it's true or not, whether it works or not. So this, you can see, has this very strong experimental, non-dogmatic, but again, you know, you don't have to leave your critical thinking, your logical, analytical thinking, you know, at the door, right? You know, you can bring it in. So as you hear the teachings, as you know, you can go, does this make sense? Right? Is this rational? Does this accord with my experience? So awakening is the first one. Second interesting thing about this community is that we practice non-denominational Buddhism. So let me just read what it says and I'll explain it. While practicing within the Mahayana Zen tradition, we take inspiration and guidance from the full breadth of Buddhist teachings. We are creative and experimental in our forms since we desire to be relevant and accessible to American culture, issues, and vernacular. We apply the Buddhist teachings based on their appropriateness to the individuals being taught and practice skillfulness in our application. So again, that's just saying in our approach, even as within Buddhism, we are different in the sense, you know, we are not are people here familiar with Buddhism at all? Some people familiar with Buddhism? Anybody totally unfamiliar with Buddhism? Okay. So as you know, there are Buddhist traditions. You know, you go to a Zen center and you'll see what?
Zen.
And the interesting thing is you go to a Japanese Zen center, a Chinese Zen center, you'll see Korean Zen center. It'll be a little different. Okay, but basically you're probably just getting Zen and Zen teachings. You go to a Theravadan center and you'll get Theravadan teachings. You go to a Tibetan center, you get Tibetan teachings. So you're getting Buddhism developed many streams because it was not monolithic. So as it went from country to country, culture to culture, it took on a lot of the attributes of that culture and emphasized certain things and not other things. So, you know, one of the things I learned from Thich Nhat Hanh early on was we need to be willing to access the full breadth of the Buddha's teachings, to see the wisdom that has been gained in various traditions, and to make use of it. In other words, to be non-sectarian, non-denominational, which I also think for our world, which often is suffering from over-sectarianism, as you, I don't need to tell you, right? That I think that's very healthy to have this kind of open and respectful saying, yeah, all Buddhist traditions have a certain degree of wisdom and understanding, and we can learn, and there've been many great teachers in all the traditions. So if you're part of our community, you'll see, you know, we teach lots of different things here, and we pull from wherever there is wisdom and relevance. You know, we make use of it, but generally we work within the Buddhist tradition. Not saying that other, religions and spiritual path don't have, good things about them, right? But, you know, this is all we know. It's like, so don't go to a French restaurant and ask for pizza, right? If you want good pizza, go to a pizza restaurant. You see what I'm saying? So, what does that mean? That means, you know, this is the meal we serve, right? And when we do our best to cook it well, and we do our best to serve it in a pleasing way. But again, if you're looking for other food, go there. The third one is community. Having the support and personal connection with the Sangha community of spiritual friends and caring for each other are key elements of the Buddhist path. We seek to live our path with the support of our harmonious practice community. So Sangha building, which is building community, is in itself a meaningful and deep practice which embodies interconnectedness instead of separateness. So this is, again, getting back to a sort of what I read yesterday, read earlier, and really I think one of the key things that also Thich Nhat Hanh has stressed, you know, we live in a society where a lot of the connections that people felt are no longer operating for so many. You know what I'm saying? So if you think back a generation or two, for those you maybe who remember some could be your parents, for some could be your grandparents. They went to work and they worked there for 40 years and then they retired, right? You know? And they had connections with the people they worked with because they knew them. They work with them continuously. People lived in the same neighborhood, right? Grew up in the neighborhood, lived in the neighborhood, knew their neighbors, died in the neighborhood, right? You see what I'm saying? You know, people lived in the same town, in the same community. So people felt much more rooted and much more sure of their place and connections, right? Families were bigger. You know, you go back to your grandparents, great grandparents, they might have had how many kids? 11, anybody else, right? 7, you know, 17, you see, I mean, right? You know, and that was just one family, right? And then you had your aunts and uncles and your cousins. And so, you know, people had extended families. You see what I'm saying? So one of the things that Thich Nhat Hanh noticed when he came to the West was, because he came out of this traditional, you know, culture, was, wow, we are so rootless, you see? We move about. I mean, how many people do you know buy a home and live in it their whole life? How many people stay in the same job their whole life? How many people haven't moved around? I mean, do you know what I'm talking about? And we're not unusual. Right? People change their jobs, what, every what now? What? Two years? 2 years now? I mean, people move every 3 to 5 years. I mean, it's... I mean, do you understand what I'm talking about? So that produces a kind of a rootlessness and a lack of connection. So Thich Nhat Hanh, he really understood two things. He understood that social piece, and he went, you know, people are searching for connection. They want community. And the traditional, you know, forms of connection, big extended families, neighborhoods, you know, people you work with your whole life, aren't there anymore. So it's very important that we create these kinds of communities where people can have close relations with each other, can know each other, can trust each other, can work together, that can take care of each other to kind of create those connections. So that was, so he felt the, you know, that we had to establish communities where people could come, connect, and heal and awaken collectively. The other thing he felt that was so necessary about having communities was, he felt in our current age, the distractions and diversions of everyday life, the busyness of everyday life. Everybody know what I'm talking about? You know, social media, you know what I'm saying? The endless possibilities from distractions. Right, we can be distracted from when? From the time we wake up in the morning to the time we go to bed at night, right? You know what I'm saying? It's, forgive me, I'm looking at my phone, you see? You see, and so he really felt that it is, and not as opposed to past generations. I mean, again, practice was never like, you know, easy street, but he felt for people who wanted to kind of a practice a meditative path, a spiritual path, and to be consistent so they could get benefit out of it, it is, he felt, almost impossible for people to do it on their own. That was his observation, that people need community, they need structure, they need support to support them. Because it's just so easily to get distracted, easily to go off track. And so he felt, for another reason, that's why it was very important that we create spiritual communities. Next is inclusiveness. Our community is open to anyone who is dedicated to following this path. We respect and encourage diversity. This goes back to the Buddha, right? So the Buddha didn't just wander around for 49 years teaching his Dharma, right? He did that. But the other thing he did is he created a community. It was primarily a community of monks and nuns, but also a community of laymen and laywomen. So he created a community. He felt it was necessary to hold his teachings. The other interesting thing was quite revolutionary. In his Sangha, which was his monastic community, you know who he let in? Well, before he let in women. Women are a little more difficult. I'll tell you about it. He let in untouchables. Anybody know about the caste system in India? There are untouchables. Untouchables meant what? I mean, they're still in India today. In other words, there were the whole class of people, a caste, that if you even touch them, or if they touched anything of yours, you would be polluted. They were untouchable, you see? He let them into his Sangha. No caste system in his Sangha. This was revolutionary at his time. And then his mother-in-law, I mean his mother had died, his stepmother, Prajnapati, after he had been teaching for decades, and she saw how he was creating this Sangha for monks, men, she said, what? I want to be a nun. Now, very difficult for him. You know why? And you have to kind of go back in time. You can't judge because of today's standards. In those days, were women free to do what they wanted? Anybody remember? What? No. Women what? Property of their birth family, right? And at a certain point, it was arranged for them to go to their husband's family, at which point they became what? The property of that family. So women, you did not see women moving around the world individually. You saw men, but you never saw a woman moving around individually. Right? So when his stepmother said, I want to become a nun, you see, which means to what? To step out of that whole very ensnared tradition for women. He didn't say yes right away because he knew the implications of it, right? But she was a stepmom, his mother. And she persisted, and he did create an order for nuns, which again was radical at that time. So what am I saying? I'm saying it goes back to the Buddha, that, this thing about inclusiveness, it goes back to him. The Buddha's path is open to everybody. Fundamental teaching of Buddhism is everybody is a Buddha. Everybody has the Buddha nature. Everybody is whole and pure. It has nothing to do with any kind of all the ways the society defines, discriminates, separates people, right? According to every quality they could imagine, they'll separate you from. The Dharma isn't like that. Everybody is pure. But we had to say it. So we respect and encourage diversity. Next is mindful living. We practice an engaged form of Buddhism that is relevant to the lives of our members, society we live in. We utilize the broad traditional teachings and practice, but applied in a modern context of life. We learn how to live an awakened life in the midst of our relationships and everyday activities, dedicated to leading a meaningful, open, and joyful life, guided by the five mindfulness trainings of the Plum Village tradition. So again, this is mindful living. This is really Thich Nhat Hanh's, engaged Buddhism. So we are not a temple Buddhism. Our center is not a place where you come to worship, where you come to just hear a sermon, about dogma, right? What we try to apply here is Buddhist teachings that are relevant to people's lives. It's engaged in people's lives. It helps us be better, happier in our lives, in our family, in our work, in our society. So it's an engaged form of Buddhism. Is that clear? So that's what we mean by a mindful living. Service, we bring joy and reduce suffering by being of service to our families, community, society. Practice love and action. We believe, I'm going to just go quickly because I want to hear from you. The next one is deep sharing, deep listening. We create trust within our community of practitioners by encouraging that everyone speak from our hearts and listen to each other without judgment. And last but not least, our teachers have received their authorization from within the continuous lineage of the Buddha. The direct personal relationship between teacher and student is central to the true Dharma transmission within the Buddhist tradition. So again, this is, this is kind of acknowledging that the tradition, at least in Zen and Dzogchen, the main meditative traditions, is a living transmission from teacher to student. Okay? It's not like you go take a class, right? And you learn it. It's not like you get a degree, from a theological school, right? It's not academic. So the idea that our community has a living teacher who has received living transmission from his teachers, so therefore is not making it up, right? Not kind of putting his little mishmash together and calling it Buddhism, but that this is an authentic transmission of Buddhism applied in the current, and that within this community, the teacher does his best to be open and have a personal relationship to offer guidance to the students. So that's another hallmark of our community, that we really feel the centrality. And it's not just a teacher. All new members get mentors, an individual mentor for senior students. So we want, we don't want to be an institution, an organization, right? Where people just sit and gobble up learning. Because there's no, I often say, it's great if you teach yourself the piano, but how do you know you play any good if you don't get feedback? I mean, you may think you're what? A virtuoso. You sit down to the piano, you bang things out, and you go, wow, I'm really getting pretty good at this, right? But it doesn't really mean. So traditionally in Buddhism, the interaction between teacher and student is able to maintain the quality of the transformation. Because has anybody noticed how easily it is to fool ourselves about what's really going on within us? For example, we always think we're right, don't we? Have anybody noticed that? Right? We always think we're right. Doesn't matter what the situation we're with, whatever it is, we always think we're right. But that can't possibly be. Because if everybody is right, everyone understand what I mean? So it's often hard for us to really see ourselves clearly. If we want to see how we look, we can look in the mirror, and the mirror doesn't lie. The mirror gives us an objective reflection of really how we look. But how many of us say, I can really look at myself, and I can see myself with that kind of clarity? I really know what's causing me to act the way and react the way I do. It's not easy, is it, to have that kind of insight into one's own self? So to have teachers, to have mentors, to have spiritual friends is also very much part of this tradition to help us, right? To help us. Until we gain the ability to have that kind of clarity. So it's not like about creating dependence, you know what I'm saying? But it's about, people need, we're learning something. Anything we learn, any skill we've learned, any competency we've developed, in art, in music, in work, and sports, we've done it with what? Teachers, mentors. And one of the function of a good teacher is what? They correct us. They say, no, that's not good. Let me show you how to draw that. Let me show you how to do that, you see? So that kind of feedback and guidance is very helpful. So those are the vision, the mission, and the core values of the Florida Community of Mindfulness. I'm just sharing them today because, again, we had our board meeting. These were looked at, and I think it's good for our community once a year to kind of just, hold ourselves accountable, so to speak. So I'm open if there are any questions about what you've heard. It's a little warm in here. Just me, okay. Are there any questions online, in the hall, anything? Please feel free, you know, don't feel, you know. So a couple of questions in the back, Well, just hold on, because people are online. And if anybody has a question, just raise their hand. Brian, you can see them.
Hi, I just wanted to know, will these be available online?
Yeah, so these are always available online. If you go to the Florida Community Mindfulness website, and there's something called About or About Us. You click on that, you know how it comes down, you'll see Values Mission. So it's available there for anyone to look at. Any other questions or comments on what you've heard today?
We have some questions online.
Okay.
First off, I want to let people online know that if you have a question, rather than raising your hand, just type it in and I will relay it to Fred. And we have one from Jordan Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I've heard Thich Nhat Hanh speak of aimlessness. Could you please help me understand how to practice this and also keep a purpose in mind? Also, I'm moving to Washington, D.C., but I wanted to thank you and everyone at FCM for being a wonderful refuge and resource for me during difficult times.
So again, aimlessness is a whole Dharma talk in itself. We don't have time to say. But basically, when we hear, this is like a Zen teaching, right? And Zen teaching is a lot about inner life, right? So you hear these very contradictory statements like, such as, how can one have an aim and be aimless at the same time, right? To our dualistic thinking mind, that sounds like what? Contradiction. So the Buddhist way of looking at things is very different than the either-or way, which is where we live. Buddhism really talks about both and. Very different. Both and. Okay? So my aim is to get to the top of the mountain. Okay? That's my purpose. My purpose is to walk this path and get to the top of the mountain. Okay? Is that clear? That's my aim. How do I do it? Aimlessly. What does that mean? Outwardly, I'm going there. Inwardly, I'm not even thinking about. I'm walking the path. So I am aimless. I'm just alive, present, enjoying every step, enjoying what I'm doing. You see, I'm aimless as an inner state. But outwardly, I'm heading in that direction. And that's a very deep teaching in Zen, you know, how we want to live. You know, it's like we want to, you know, it's like work. You know, we have Saturday mornings where we practice work meditation. People go, work meditation? You know, maybe somebody might think, oh, they're just trying to fool us. You know, they really want us to come in and do work, but we'll just, you know, add on meditation and it'll give it a little bit of a, you know, those Zen people, very tricky. But actually, in Zen, you learn how to work. And it's a different way of working than we work. We work for what purpose? To make money, we have a goal, right? But think about the way we actually work. Do we work with joy in this culture? People are laughing. It's like, what? Hold on. You mean when you went to work and they told you about the job, they didn't tell you about the cultivation of joy is very essential for your... No. No. How does one work? Here's another big one. We work primarily to what? To get it done. Anybody notice that? How quick can I get this job done so then I can do something else? Right. So We don't work with ease, and we don't work with joy, and we don't work with presence. So in our tradition, learning to work with presence, to be present to whatever I'm doing, to not carrying anything from the past, to not anticipating anything in the future. The future will get here when it gets here. The next task will be taken care of when I deal with it. Learning to be just totally present to what I'm doing right now, to give it my full attention, and to do it with ease. In other words, I'm not uptight. My body's relaxed, my mind's relaxed, I'm fully present. You know what you'll find? You'll be a lot more productive than often the way you work now. And you know what? At the end of the day, you may not be so stressed out if you work in this way. You actually may find you're going to be more productive, because we waste a lot of time and we burn up a lot of time and tightness, and you know, we're doing three things at once, but we're really not. All you're ever doing is one thing at a time. You can't really do three things at once. All you can ever do is one thing at a time. But if you it doesn't create happiness, doesn't create ease, doesn't create joy. And how many people here still work for a living, aren't retired? How many hours you work? All the hours. Yeah. So learning to work as a meditative practice, you see, is very important for you, because you don't spend most of your day on a meditation cushion, do you? No, you see. So, you know, learning to have a formal meditative practice can be a kind of a generator for you. But you know, active people need to learn a meditation that works for them. This is engaged Buddhism. So you want to bring the practice into your work. You want to bring the practice into your family life. That's what needs to be transformed. It's very important. And again, because we spend so much of our life at work. And for those of you in school, I consider that work, you know. So if you're in school, that's work. That's your work. And again, how do you do that? You know, do you do that with joy? Do you do that with ease? Or do you just kind of, how can I get through this so I can get to the fun part of life? But you see, we're alive when we're doing all. I mean, that's our life, you see. Whatever we're doing is our life. At that moment, that's our life. Why don't we enjoy it? Any other questions? Yes.
I just really had so much of an aha moment. The job that I'm doing now, I used to have the number of tasks that you could complete in a single day. So I would start my morning, and by the end of the day, they were done. And then I'd have new things the next day. But it seems like since COVID, or maybe a little bit after, the amount of work that needs to be done is way more than you could possibly do in a day. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of stressing, you know. Yeah. And then, you know, I come here every week and things kind of filter in, but you don't always recognize what's filtered in. It's just kind of in you. And I started this perspective of, I've got this amount of hours to work. I will sort things by priority, and I will just work on them until the day is done. And my goal is not to get it all done, because that's very stressing and anxiety provoking, because you know you can't, right?
Can I tell you a secret?
Yeah.
You'll never get it all done.
Exactly. Exactly. And it started pouring out.
They're fooling you. You'll never get it done, because if you ever get it all done, they'll just give you more.
There you go, right? But it poured out even from work, you know? It poured out into the house. Like, you're not going to get every inch of the house clean. You're not going to get every book read. You're not, like, it just sort of went everywhere. Yeah, and it was so, like, relaxing. And I don't think, but just today, like it all, like, clicked together as this, like, aha moment of, oh my gosh, like, So thank you.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, it's so simple. We want to be happy. Is that true? Does anybody here want to be unhappy? Is that anybody here have the goal of life to be suffer and be miserable? No, I mean, we all would like to be happy, wouldn't we? We'd all like to have anybody not want to have a peaceful mind? Anybody not want to have an open heart? I mean, you see, these are non-brainers. Either, you know, when we think about that, yeah, that's what I'd like. And yet, when it comes to my daily life, do I ever think that way? It's like I just forget about it. Like, oh, today, I got all these things to do, but you know what? I want to be calm. I want to cultivate somewhat of a happy mind during the day. Right? Yeah. I want to be open-hearted to everyone I encounter. Makes a difference. Okay, well, thank you, everyone. Thank you for coming today. Thank you for listening.